So, you know, in that regard, certainly kind of a pretty historic start to the Oscars.
Yeah. Ebony, did you watch the Oscars? I don't think you did. Yeah, I didn't think you did. Welcome to Feminist Frequency Radio. This is episode 66. I'm Anita Sarkeesian, and I'm joined, as always, by two other angry meat bodies, Carolyn Pettit and Ebony Adams.
Ew. I get what you're doing there because Alita Battle Angel, but ew.
Blame Ebony.
Yeah.
This is the show that asks you to be critical of the media you love, or alternatively, we're the feminist killjoys coming for your media, depending on your perspective. Today, we're going to be talking about results and reactions to last night's Academy Awards. It wasn't last night when you get this, but it's last night to us now. And double feature, we're going to be talking about the live-action manga film Alita: Battle Angel. After that, if we have any brain power left, we'll finish the show by each sharing a little something in What's Your Freak Out? Now on with the show. Hey, y'all, I would just like to shout out Throat Coat Tea. The throat
tastes
coat
disgusting,
tea.
But it does work.
I wasn't aware we started taking endorsements again.
We should get an endorsement from Throat Coat. Although I think they have the market already like pretty tapped. They don't even need to promote that shit because everybody I know that is a performer uses it. It helps.
I would love it if we did start repping Throat Coat, because all other podcasts, it seems like it's, you know, mattresses or Squarespace, you know, or Blue Apron. But let's do something different.
Hey, traditional medicine. What are they? Traditional medicine? Medicinals?
Traditional medicinals. Traditional medicinals.
I was like, what?
Anita is our host.
Hey, y'all, reach out to us. I'll learn how to say your name properly if you pay us. How's everyone doing?
Yeah, good. This morning I am podcasting or recording from an actual amazing little podcast chamber. It is just this, you know, very small but very kind of comfortable room. I can't be in my apartment right now because there's some weird issue with carbon monoxide there. So that's fun.
We don't want you to die. Don't die.
Okay, I won't die. I spent the weekend in a motel at a cheap not cheap because it's Berkeley, but the cheapest motel near me that I could find. But this room, yeah, I feel like I'm in a spaceship or something because I feel so isolated.
I was going to ask, does it feel like you're in an isolation tank?
Kind of, yeah, but in a good way.
We're going to have to share everyone a photo. Take a photo when we're done.
Yes, I will. And we'll put it in the show stuff.
You're going to have a Jacob's Ladder kind of experience in there, and you're going to come out and realize this has all been a dream.
Oh, man. The ending of that movie messed me up when I was a kid.
I don't even know this movie.
Okay.
Of course you don't.
Okay.
All right. Here we go. Here it starts. So it begins.
Speaking of movies. So the Academy Awards just happened, and instead of doing like a typical entertainment news where we talk about things other than the Academy Awards, this week I think we're just going to talk about the Academy Awards, because holy cow, there is so much to talk about.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, so they started actually pretty strong. You had Regina King win Best Supporting Female Actor for Beale Street. You had Ruth Carter win Costume Design for Black Panther. She is... I read online that she's the first African-American person to win. So I don't know if she may not be the first Black person, but apparently she's the first African-American person to win. I don't know. Hannah Beachler won production design for Black Panther, a Black woman. And I saw a tweet online from Kyle Buchanan. He tweeted, only three Black women have won Oscars for anything other than acting, and two of them just happened tonight. So, you know, in that regard, certainly kind of a pretty historic start to the Oscars.
Yeah. Ebony, did you watch the Oscars? I don't think you did. Yeah, I didn't think you did. Okay,
no,
so here's the
not.
Thing. I wasn't actually planning on watching them because I had other plans that I totally bailed on, because I was like, holy shit, these Oscars. Like, I just kind of started watching them. They're really, I'm really glad I did. Like, this was different. And I don't have hope for the future by any means, but I'm glad that I got to witness this moment. It was the blackest fucking Oscars I've ever seen. Like,
it was, oh my God.
I'm just
bold, Anita. Bold.
Look, Regina King, Spike Lee, Mahershala Ali,
Peter Ramsey.
Peter Ramsey.
One best director.
Yeah, Spider-Man.
One for Spider-Man, directing Spider-Man, yeah.
Yep. And then you have Alfonso Cuarón, who won like a bajillion awards for Roma. Mexican dude.
He won best cinematography,
foreign film,
and best director.
Yep. I really don't think Rami Malek should have won for best actor in that lineup of roles, but like, he's an Egyptian dude. Like, I'm so here for all of this, man. Like, it was monumental. Black Panther won for best score, production design, and costume design. Bao won for short animated. For best short animated film. Like, it was the amount of people of color on that stage was unlike anything I've seen at an awards show before.
Hold on.
Don't just hold on. The other thing about it is that there was so much Spanish speaking. Like, and I say so much in that, like, there were moments of it, but in a way that, like, American media has been very hesitant to have languages other than English in the media, right? That without subtitles, without anything, because they don't want to be alienating, blah, 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 blah. There was just, like, straight up Spanish spoken on stage. And one of my favorite moments of the whole award show was when Alfonso Cuarón said, "Do I get subtitles too?"
Yeah, oh, I loved that Alfonso Cuarón, when accepting Best Foreign Language Film, in his speech, he said something great. He was like, "You know, when I was young, I was inspired by a lot of foreign language films, Citizen Kane, Jaws, you know," yeah. And he names these English language films as foreign language films, right? Kind of, you know, saying, kind of spotlighting that, hey, film is kind of universal and we really shouldn't need these divisions in the first place.
Yeah, that was a beautiful moment. There was so much good shit. And like, the structure of it without having a host totally worked. It felt like it was moving along very quickly in a way that like award shows feel very stilted. There was some really weird camera work. I don't know if anyone else noticed that, but like, that whatever. There was some weird cinematography shit happening, especially in the last half of it, that I was like, what the hell? Did you watch the performance with Bradley Cooper and Lady Gaga? Like, the angle in which they shot that was so fucking weird and uncomfortable.
No. Oh, I loved that. I actually thought that performance, everything about it was wonderful. Like, I thought the intimacy of it was amazing. I thought that they kind of acted it as well as singing it, and I really believed in this like depth of emotion between them. I thought that the camera was right there. On
that
top
intense
of,
staring
them.
Contest they had made me very uncomfortable.
I thought it was. Oh, you're not a romantic at all. I thought it was really.
I thought it was really beautiful. I just am selective about how to do it. Okay. The other thing I want to point out is that I loved the choice that they made in terms of who to introduce the Best Picture winner nominees. So in the Oscars, like throughout the whole show, they showcase all of the Best Picture nominees, right? And usually someone introduces them. This year, they chose people mostly outside, like, you know, outside of the sort of standard establishment to introduce these films. And I really loved the choices they made for a lot of them. So Serena Williams introducing A Star is Born, which she was just a really nice touch in terms of like working hard to get to where you are. Barbara Streisand introducing Black Klansman, and that exchange between her and Spike Lee shouting, and then Spike Lee shouting out Brooklyn from the audience was fucking everything. Like, I want that movie. I don't know what it is, but I want that fucking movie.
Barbara Streisand, Spike Lee, Brooklyn buddy movie.
Yes, right?
Yeah,
oh,
absolutely.
I watched the shit out of that. I really loved Queen Latifah introducing The Favorite by saying, "It's not easy being a queen."
Ah, yes.
But yeah, so then you had like Tom Morello from Rage Against the Machine introduce Vice. Trevor Noah introduced Black Panther, who did some real good jabs at Mel Gibson.
Yeah. And then, though, Green Book.
Oh, wait, hold on.
Okay.
Hold on. Bohemian Rhapsody was introduced by Mike Myers and Dana Carvey.
Yes.
Which was so good because they showed the Wayne's World clip of them singing Queen before. Anyways, there were so many things I liked, okay? Like, yeah. I'm shocked. Now we can do it. Let's do it.
So Green Book, one of the people presenting Green Book was John Lewis, which as a tweet
Georgia
I saw.
Georgia representative.
Yeah. You know, major, like civil rights figure, right? I mean, Yeah. I saw a tweet that basically said, you know, getting John Lewis up there to present Green Book is some major PR jujitsu. Like, you know, it's true. Like, you can definitely see them, like, trying to deflect criticism of the movie or whatever by getting a figure like John Lewis up there to present the film and to talk about, you know, from a place of deep feeling about, you know, what the American South was like at that time. You know, it was like, oh, it's powerful that you're up there, man. But boy, this movie does not deserve your words or your respect or your endorsement.
I found that very disappointing.
Yeah, I don't blame John Lewis for not, you know, understanding the impact of the film in the, you know, but still, it was frustrating.
And he introduced it with Amanda Sternberg, who was in that movie, The Hate U Give, about you know, violence against Black communities and police brutality and stuff like that. So it was just so like, ugh. So this whole time, for the most part, I'm like, holy shit, the Oscars are really doing something different this year.
Yeah.
And also, recognizing difference this year. And then they announced the Best Picture winner.
Yes. Which, of course, it was, I've reluctantly been predicting for the past several weeks, it was Green Book.
It was Green Book.
And you know what was like so many amazing things, and by amazing, I mean, you know, oh my God, moments about the Green Book's time on stage as the Best Picture winner. First of all, a sea of white faces, just a sea
so
of white faces.
So many white people.
I mean, you have like all these white people, and then you have like Octavia Spencer and Mahershala Ali, and then like all these other white people. And then on top of that, I think it was Peter Farrelly, or, you know, one of the people during their acceptance speech was like, you know, like, we wouldn't have had a movie without Vigo. You know, Mahershala did some good work, but you know, then it's totally like, yes, because your movie is totally about the white guy. Exactly. Like, it was just this amazing moment of, yeah, we get it. We get it, man. Oh, my God.
It was so disappointing. Like, I actually screamed very loudly. Like, I'm sure all my neighbors heard me, because I was like, why? Like, I know why, and I shouldn't expect more, but it was just like, I think we got so softened by like the previous 2 hours of the show.
I was like, oh, maybe there is reason to be hopeful now. And then that happens. And it really, you know, because it is the most prestigious award, the biggest, most important award of the night, it does cast a pall on the whole night to some degree, right? But, I mean, not to say that the historic and deserving wins earlier in the night by Black women and other non-white, you know, people were insignificant, because they are very significant, but nonetheless, you know, very disappointing ending to what was often a great night.
Ebony, you got anything to add?
No.
Well, I do want to shout out, I love that. So Ruth Carter is a very established, prolific costume designer in Hollywood. And she's done like so many movies. And I loved her speech, or I loved parts of it at least. She got up there and she said, it's about time. Like I imagine for a lot of people that feels really arrogant, but also like, if you know her history in Hollywood, like, yeah, it's about time she win a goddamn award, right? And her shout out to Spike Lee, who I like helped her get started, I believe, or like gave her her first opportunity on Do the Right Thing. So there's just a lot of like, there's a lot of kind of camaraderie in some ways. I forget her name, who was doing. What does she win for? Black Panther. Sorry,
The production design, Hannah Beachler.
Yeah, the production design. Sorry, the woman like was crying and talking about how Ryan Coogler like changed her life. And you know, I'm not saying this to be like, oh, women owe a debt to men, but that like there is such a lifting up relationship that I think is so important. And I think we've talked about this on the podcast about how people like. Like Ava DuVernay is probably one of the biggest examples of this, of like a woman who has established herself and is trying to lift up her community, right? And giving opportunities. And so I liked that bit that I saw in the Oscars last night.
Yeah. Yeah. I do have to mention, though, about the Best Picture winner, sort of adding insult to injury, is that, you know, is that Spike Lee and Black Klansman lost to Green Book, which weirdly mirrors the fact that Driving Miss Daisy won the year that that Do the Right Thing came out. And, you know, so Spike Lee was like, backstage, he was like, you know, whenever somebody's driving somebody else, I lose.
Oh, my God. Did you see? So there's a clip going around, too, where Spike Lee is backstage and they ask him about Green Book and he's just like sipping his champagne.
Yeah.
Next question.
Yep.
And you're like, yeah.
Yes.
God, fuck that movie. All right. Shall we move on to another? Oh, wait. Hold on. Sorry.
Yeah.
I got to shout out Olivia Colman.
Yes.
I know that what's her name? Probably like should have won. And I think
Glenn Close
should have won.
Yes.
She won in terms of like, you know, the Oscars often give awards for like a body of work. Right. Like it's like you haven't won yet and
exactly.
You deserve to win. And she was amazing in The Wife. But God, I want more Olivia Colman in my life. Like her acceptance speech was the best thing ever. She was so flustered. She just was just adorable and wonderful. And, you know,
yeah. I love her like blowing a raspberry at the, you know, because she's like, oh, please wrap up quickly. Oh, you know,
and it was so cute.
Yeah.
So, yeah, very mixed. I mean, not super mixed feelings. Like, I really am impressed. I hope that this isn't a one-time thing, and it might be, and it depends on so many things, right? It depends on what kind of movies we get this year. It depends on how, like, if the Academy feels like they, like, did their due diligence in 2019 and don't have to do it again in the future, right? Like, I don't know what the tone is that we're going to move forward, but I'm going to take this as a win for now.
I'm taking it as a win for Billy Porter. Moving on.
Oh, yeah.
Billy Porter. All right. If you don't know what we're talking about, go look at his Oscar outfit because it's the best thing in the world. Okay. Oh, wait. Sorry. We have to acknowledge one more thing. I'm sorry. That nobody who won an award for Bohemian Rhapsody thanked Bryan Singer. Thank God.
Right. Yes. That was actually, it kind of started turning into a little game for me. Like, is this person going to mention Bryan Singer? Like, no, they didn't. You know, because if Bohemian Rhapsody had won Best Picture, imagine everyone up there trying to talk around and not mention Bryan Singer once.
Right?
Oh, that would. I mean, I'm very glad. I mean, Bohemian Rhapsody winning would have been in the same ballpark as Green Book winning. I don't want either of them to win, but yeah.
I don't know how much money Bohemian Rhapsody threw into lobbying efforts, but I don't understand why it is even in the running for anything.
The most egregious win of Bohemian Rhapsody for the night, in my mind, was editing. Like, it won editing,
right?
And there is actually a clip going around on Twitter from the movie that's just showing how bad, like, it is a badly edited movie. Like, there are editing decisions where you're just like, why did you cut away then? What was the point of that? What is happening? It's like incoherent. And
there
yet
is
it
some
won
very
best
weird
editing.
Yeah, there's some very weird behind the scenes lobbying shit that's happening with that movie to get it to have this much attention, because it's not that strong of a film at all.
Yep.
About the editing nomination, I heard a really interesting take on that, which is that for many of those kinds of categories, the voting is done by people who are specialists and professionals in the field, unlike the Best Picture category, which is voted on by everybody. And so in some ways, the nomination of Bohemian Rhapsody for editing, when people are clowning that it, you know, it was like it did the absolute most, is sort of an acknowledgement that the film was sort of handed to editors half done because Bryan Singer just bounced and left the country. And, you know, there was an attempt to, you know, sort of make up a film out of the parts and pieces that they had been given. So it was an acknowledgement at that level. And so sometimes wins or nominations in those, you know, specialized categories reflect a different kind of thinking than is true for something like Best Picture.
And for all I know, it actually, maybe Bryan Singer gave them such scraps of usable footage that maybe the editing actually is a tremendous feat given what they had to work with. That's entirely possible. But I don't think that means it should have won, but nonetheless.
No.
Did you know that it is because of you that we can keep bringing Feminist Frequency Radio to the airwaves? It's true. We are listener supported. So please consider joining our podcast community at d.rip/femfreak, where you'll get access to some fun perks and bonus episodes. And if you have a Kickstarter account, it's super easy because that's all you need to start a Drip account. Ta-da! So please join us at d.rip/femfreak. All right, moving on to the main segment. Ebony, how about you introduce us to the topic this week?
Right on. So, Alita Battle Angel is the most recent film by Robert Rodriguez, known for directing things like Spy Kids, The Faculty, numerous other things. And it is a $200 million sci-fi epic in which a young and amnesiac cyborg woman is basically rescued from a giant trash heap, outfitted with some futuristic tech, and then rollerblades her way into social justice activism. The film is based on a 1990s manga series and features an all-star cast, including Christoph Waltz as the kindly doctor who puts the titular Alita back together again, Jennifer Connelly as his ex-wife slash Crystal Gem, who desperately wants to move back to her deluxe apartment in the Sky High High, and Mahershala Ali as a man who should be making better choices. I have many questions.
Please, regale us with your questions.
Well, I can't give you all of them because I literally have 20 questions here that from top to bottom, my notes were all questions. But how old is Alita?
Okay, so.
Well, actually, yeah.
Is it problematic, and I would argue yes, that the doctor, upon being, you know, confronted with this head in a trash heap, envisions her as having to be a younger girl than she obviously is. But when she ages herself up, the way that she does this is by giving herself boobs and then wearing tighter clothes.
Well,
right?
Yeah. This is actually one of the things I most wanted to talk about this film. So you cut right to the chase of this aspect of the film. So there's a line. So, okay. At a certain point in the film, Alita's body is basically destroyed, the body that the doctor originally gives her, and she gets a...
Hold on. I want to give a little more context. The doctor gives Alita, like, or I guess we said it in the intro, but I think this is important. The doctor has a leftover cyborg body that his daughter, who died, is supposed to be wearing, and so he gives it to her, and that body gets destroyed.
Yes.
So there's already a bunch of really creepy, weird shit happening here.
Right. So then Alita gets this much more advanced body. It's left over from this war from 300 years ago. It's the advanced technology of the, you know, invading the, you know, who she was like part of the opposing force in that war. And as the body is being attached to her, it evolves. Right. So the nurse says, oh, looks like Alita. So the doctor says her body's changing to match her subconscious image of herself. And the nurse says, looks like she's older than you thought she was, which to me is like signal to all the, you know, anime nerds in the audience. Mm-hmm. You can now start like perving out about her. It's now appropriate. But this is so complicated in a lot of ways. Like, you know, I will say, so, you know, there has been some trans discourse about this film. And I will say that I get that. Like, as a trans woman, you know, myself trapped in this body that will never be what I want it to be and that has definitely caused me a lot of, like, discomfort and pain and makes it hard, you know, has a negative impact on my ability to get close to other people and all this. Like, of course, there's a level on which I find, like, oh, a body that just matches your image of yourself appealing. But at the same time, like, I know that this is not my fantasy, and I know that it's not made for me. It's not really about, like, to me, it's not really about Alita coming into her own in her body. There's just so many men in this movie. Like, it barely passes the Bechdel test. It's a movie totally dominated by men. I feel like her, that development is purely one intended to sexualize her for the male viewer rather than one that's trying to be like empowering for, you know, people like myself.
I sat through the 2 hours of this film knowing from pretty soon after it started that I would only be interested in reviews and reflections by trans writers or disabled writers. Like, those are the only two lenses through which I'm interested in viewing this film. And so I'm so glad that so many people within those two communities are tackling this, because it would be too simplistic to say this movie is either, you know, sort of regressive in its representations or liberatory, you know? Like, this movie is much more complicated than it has any right to be. This movie is a mess. It is an absolute mess. It's one of the few films where I felt like I knew less about what happened after I saw it than going in, you know? And yet, there is something that, like, there is the potential for a sort of, you know, subversive fan reaction to this film. And I am so glad to see people wrestling with this, because, yeah, there were moments where I thought, boy, if this were a better movie and there was better writing and more thoughtful fleshing out of what's going on here, this could be amazing.
I mean, I'm definitely, like, I'm wary of fan reaction, because I marginalized people have always had to, you know, project themselves in certain ways into media where they weren't represented, and had to kind of take scraps of representation and feel empowered by them to some degree. But I don't want trans women to pretend that this movie is something that it isn't, right? I don't want us to think that the impact this movie has for the average viewer is in any way one of like female liberation or trans liberation or anything like that. Like, we may bring those things to the movie and they're valid for us and our personal experiences of the film, but that doesn't mean that the movie is really doing that in terms of its cultural impact. If that makes sense.
When they brought the body, when they got the, like, the alien body that's supposed to match her, it's clearly what we consider to be a masculine body. And I was like,
is it?
Yeah.
That's not the way I read it.
Yeah, I didn't interpret it that way either. I didn't look closely enough at the body before it was attached to her.
It had, so I'm going to be stereotypical about how I'm addressing this in terms of the context of the movie. That is very stereotypical. It had no hips. It was a very narrow body. It had no, like, breasts. It had, like, very flat plate armor. It looked like, to me, it looked like masculine armor that you would put that you would wear in combat. So Carolyn had mentioned that there's conversations happening in the trans community around this, but I hadn't read any of it before I watched it. So when that came out, I was like, oh, this is cool. She's going to be in this body that is not, like, stereotypically feminized, and that, like, cool. Like, maybe there's some cool shit happening here. And then I was so disappointed when that moment happened that served multiple purposes, right? Where you had the male gaze of the guy, of the fucking doctor who's thinking of this girl / woman as his child, being like, holy shit, look at you, hubba hubba, right? Like, it was super disgusting that, like, her impression, her subconscious vision of herself is this very stereotypical, like, sexualized,
right,
view.
Right.
It's very, like, unless that body changes over time as you change, right? Like, if you're like, I want big boobs today, or small boobs, I'd like hips, or I'd like a narrow body, or whatever, right? Like, that would be, that's a fucking interesting ass story that I would read, but that's not what's happening here, right? Like, there's nothing about this film that is trying to push boundaries. And I think that, you know, we'll get into this, but there are a lot of other ways that it's really deeply regressive in terms of race, in terms of, you know, sexuality, in terms of, like, just straight up misogyny and shit like that.
Yeah. One of my most hated moments in the film, let's keep it on gender for the moment. The most important other female character is Shirin, played by Jennifer Connelly. And she is this woman who's kind of trapped between two more important men, right? She's trapped between the doctor, who's like her ex-husband, and they had a daughter together. That she's the daughter who died, and now she's working with Vector, Mahershala Ali's character, who's this kind of criminal lord, scavenger, king guy. But at a certain point, right? She undergoes a change of heart, and she does something kind after being kind of a bad guy for a lot of the film. And when asked why she did it, her response is included the phrase like, "I remembered that I'm a mother," and it's just this like I hate that like notion of that regressive notion of, oh, like women are inherently more nurturing. And, especially when they're mothers, they just have this like nurturing instinct, and men, like as in opposition to men who do not have that nurturing capacity or that nurturing, instinct, which is, it's just such gendered bullshit. And so like that was another thing where it's like, OK, yeah, this film, people... Anyone who walks out of this thing and this is some like feminist liberation or, even girl power narrative is kidding themselves. Like, this is a regressive, sexist, deeply sexist film.
Yeah, it's okay. A couple of things. One, so there's just a bunch of shit happening here. So I'm not like, we don't even have that much time to get into how bad the movie is. Like, the dialogue and all of the like little bits of bullshit, the like lack of emotional depth, the superficiality of it. Like, the stuff that I found so frustrating was like the casting. So people of color were always secondary in this world. It was very centered on white people and their problems. And there is a lot of folks who are like invested in the original manga who are like, this is whitewashing. And I found this quote from producer John Landau, which I think is really important here. He says, the author Yukito Kishiro did something very different. He wrote manga that is not set in an Asian world. He wrote it set in a place called Iron City, which is a melting pot. He actually set it in Kansas. Okay, so this is their excuse as to why they don't have the ghost in the shell problem, which they totally fucking have the ghost in the shell problem here. But if you have this quote-unquote melting pot, which is also a deeply problematic way to think about culture, why are all of your main characters white? If it was sincerely a actual, like, all of the world is coming to this place and it's the like the leftovers of people, basically, that would not be the case. And you can see the first people to die are black people, right? Like, everyone who isn't important is not, like, all the important people are white. The frustration with things like, okay, major spoiler warning. Mahershala Ali's character Vector barely is most of the time we see him is being possessed by Nova, the big bad. And so he's being possessed by a white person. Most of his character isn't even fucking him. And then when he gets confronted by Alita, she kills him and is like, whatever, you're just a pawn. No big deal. As if, like, I was sitting there being like, what the fuck? How is that? Like, you're supposed to be ethical?
Yeah, I had a kind of a different take on Alita because she seemed to me the very kind of science fictional notion of ethnic ambiguity. So that she could be read as various different things, right? And I do think it's important, not perhaps, important good, but I do think it's notable that the voice actor for Alita is Rosa Salazar, who is Peruvian, right? Like, I think there's something, this is what I mean when I say, like, this film is not good enough for the potential that it could have. There are things that could have been so wonderful about the way this film tackles like identity and where identity resides and, what it means to have, an able body, and like there's just so much, but the film is not good enough. But part of it is that I wonder, like, because Robert Rodriguez is an incredibly talented filmmaker.
Is he?
I feel like he's done some really cool stuff. you know? But I feel like it's too ambitious.
Also, James Cameron co-wrote this.
Cameron was like super into this, but apparently got too busy working on those Avatar sequels that no one gives a shit about. So wasn't able to, and thank God he didn't direct this film. But yeah, like I wasn't, there's no doubt that this film positions people of color on the sidelines, like they are tangential or at most sort of parallel to the main body of white supremacy as it exists in this far future world. And then, am I wrong here? I didn't have a chance to look this up, but when Alita flashes back to, you know, when she's doing like her battle angelin, you know, mm-hmm. her mentor, was that Michelle Rodriguez?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay. Okay. Again, what's going, like, there's so much that's going
on. Also, like, Nova is played by Ed Norton, which was supposed to be this big reveal.
Yo,
like,
listen.
Like, you know, it was like, nobody cares.
Yeah, I mean, I think that is this moment at the end to be like, oh, snap, Nova's Ed Norton. Can't wait for the sequel where we get to see them
absolutely
go head to head. But, like, are we even going to get that sequel?
Listen, when I first saw Nova, I thought it looks like Caesar Flickerman, the character Stanley Tucci played in Hunger Games, had a baby with Dr. Heinz Doofenshmirtz from Phineas and Ferb. They're like, real, just not okay.
Okay, we need to talk about the scene where she pulls her heart out and hands it to Hugo.
Yeah.
I'm just like...
Yeah.
Like, okay, so here, the generous reading of this is... You know, she's young and in love and going through puberty and blah, 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 blah. And you would do anything and blah, 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 blah. But no, I'm not feeling generous at all. Like that, I was like, I was cringing in my seat the whole time being like, oh, fuck.
I actually tweeted about that moment and said, like, Alita literally holding her heart in her hands out to somebody and saying, it's all or nothing with me. This is who I am. I said, like, extremely relatable moment, IMO.
Carolyn, you shared us an article on Film Freak Central, review of this that is the most brilliant thing I've read in a long time. I'll share it in the show notes. But I want to, the author of this piece describes Hugo, who's the love interest, as a pale, desperate subway busker charisma of a Blossom era Joey Lawrence. And I died because the whole time I was like, why is he so weird? And why is he so like not... anything. And I was like, oh my God, he totally, that's such a good description.
Yeah,
of it.
I think there was something vaguely familiar about him during the movie. And I think it actually was that he reminded me of Joey Lawrence. Like, I actually think that's what it was. When I read that review, I was like, oh, wait, that's it. He is kind of, there's something vague, like Joey Lawrence-ish about Hugo.
When Hugo, I had fewer problems with that scene where Alita hands Hugo or attempts to hand Hugo her heart. I had more problems with the scene where Hugo calls Alita while she's doing Motorball, like her big tryout. First of all, I thought it was Murderball. The sound editing on this film was garbage. But so she's having her big Motorball tryout. He calls her while she is in the middle of things and is like, fix my problems. And I was just like, if that ain't some typical shit, like a dude calling a woman at work and being like, I need you to come home and fix this thing. Dude, deal with your shit on your own. I was, oh my God, that kid. Also, once he was a cyborg and started climbing up the space tubes to Salem, if that's possible, why haven't other cyborgs done it? Everybody wants to get up there, right? Like, that's the dream.
Yeah, right.
You know, it seems like if you have that mechanized body, this becomes possible for you. Why are other people... None of this movie makes sense. Can I also ask a question? Maybe I missed this. Is there an explanation in the film, not in the wider manga universe of this series, but in the film, for why people are living in Iron City, in the scrapyard, and not escaping into the Badlands? The Badlands are beautiful. Like, do we get an explanation for that? Like, why are people stacked,
right,
you know, on top of each other?
No.
When they could be living out there, working those farms, doing whatever, you know? Also, why has no one bothered to explore that Erm spaceship? Why are these kids, these literal children, the only people who have explored this Erm ship with all that tech? That's apparently
they said,
still usable.
But they said scavengers went in there. They did write that off. And, like, she could only open it because she is one of them.
Yeah, I think they did say something like, oh, we don't even, like, this technology is so advanced that we don't even know how to use it. Something like that.
I guess I remember that now, but that seems like an insufficient answer. Like, wouldn't it make more sense for, like, the authorities, such as they are during this period, to have found that ship and, like, installed it in a lab somewhere such that they could try and take it apart? But no, they just left it there? Yeah, it makes no fucking sense.
Yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right. At the same time, if this movie had been better in other ways, you know, I would totally be willing to forgive those kinds of lapses in plot logic because at a certain point, they don't really matter if the movie is successful in making us care about its characters and their struggles and things like that.
Carolyn, what you're talking about, like, I feel like the show did not do the work to earn the emotional stakes it was trying to create. The show, the movie, whatever.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Like, it goes for these moments of deeply felt emotion, but it hasn't earned those.
Well, that's because the central conceit of the film that you can be super good at murder ball and make it up to those deluxe apartments in the sky is so low stakes. Like, I couldn't believe that ultimately so much of this film was gonna hinge upon murder ball.
Like, so the shit around where she, like, so she goes into the hunter warrior bar. And she does her stupid ass speech that you're like, oh my God, it's so embarrassing. And then she's like, okay, that whole thing happens. Fast forward to they're trying to pay all of the hunter warriors off to kill her. And so they're playing in the audition together and she doesn't recognize any of them. These people that she literally just hung out with for like at least 30 minutes. Right? Like, it's just, ugh.
How did she get to be a hunter warrior? What is the process? Do you just apply? Do you just
That's
say,
what she
I want
did.
To be a... Right.
Yeah, it seems pretty simple. She just walks in and 2 minutes later, she walks out with a badge and she's a hunter warrior.
Seems like a system that would break down at any moment.
Sure does.
Okay, I know we don't have time to get into this as much as I want to, but I really, really want to talk to people. So hit me up on Twitter about this film's understanding of disability.
It's so bad, right?
It is. It is so bad, and yet it is bad in really, I think, useful ways. So one of the ways that I started thinking about this, and I owe this to Dr. Sammy Schalk, and I can't recommend her book, Body Minds Reimagined, enough. We'll put a link to it. But I believe that based upon the kind of theoretical framework that she lays out, this would be called, or could be labeled what she terms like a super-powered super-crip narrative. And so I want to think through the ways in which this film sort of posits who's disabled and who isn't, and what makes someone disabled in the universe of this film, where disability begins and ends, why we might not think of Alita herself as being a disabled person, but why we might think about other cyborgs in the film as disabled. I just think like there's so much going on here about the ways that we sort of, you know, have to make disability kind of extraordinary for it to be accepted, and also how we collapse it down to the level of the individual and sort of completely elide any of the, you know, kind of social questions that would obtain in a world in which almost everyone has some sort of cybernetic modification, right? You know, and how like the role of race and, you know, conventional attractiveness plays in this world. I just think like this film is going to be one that I can imagine disability scholars talking about for ages, because the narrative tropes that it deploys to kind of dance around whether Alita is disabled. No, she's not. But the daughter who would have had her body is, like, where does disability lie? You know, yeah. And why would we be uncomfortable thinking of Alita as disabled, but not perhaps the nurse who has a cybernetic arm or someone who has, you know, a cybernetic eye or legs in this film? So, yeah, like I said, I know we don't have time to get into it, but I'm obsessed with this right now. And again, definitely read Dr. Sammy Schalk on this. She's amazing. So hit me up on Twitter if you want to talk it through, because I definitely want to talk it through.
All right, y'all. Let's move on to this week's What's Your Freakout? Who wants to go first?
I'll get us started.
All right.
So a few years ago on the Nintendo Wii U, a game came out called New Super Mario Brothers U. And it's a, you know, it's a 2D Mario game like the early, you know, Mario games were, Super Mario Brothers 1, 2, 3, etc. And I hadn't been very impressed by earlier games in the New Super Mario Brothers series. I thought that the level design was very bland and that the games just felt like this very half-hearted attempt to kind of cash in on people's nostalgic affection for the early 2D Mario games. But New Super Mario Brothers U, when I played that a few years ago on the Wii U, I was really impressed by it. I thought, oh, here's, you know, the new 2D Mario game I've been waiting for. It has fantastic level design, really charming worlds, and just, you know, different details and things that kind of change up the gameplay from time to time, and you know, and it's just the right amount of challenging. You know, most players can approach it and have a good experience with it, but if you want to go the route of like collecting all of the things, you know, you're in for a very satisfying but very, very tough challenge. And anyway, it was recently re-released on the Nintendo Switch as New Super Mario Brothers U Deluxe, and I had a chance to play some of that recently, and it's, you know, it reminded me just how great that game is. So, you know, if you like 2D Mario games and you never owned a Wii U, as many people never did, or just for whatever reason you never had a chance to play New Super Mario Brothers U, you know, I definitely think that it is a cut above other recent 2D Mario games, and that it is lots of fun, really lots of fun, and well worth your time.
Awesome.
Excellent. Ebony, what are you freaking out about this week?
I'm freaking out about the Netflix show Flavorful Origins, which I recommended to you, I think, over the weekend, Anita, or earlier. Anyways, it is a fantastic, mesmerizing look into Chaoshan cuisine, which is the region of China in Guangdong, and I'm mispronouncing that, and I apologize. I practiced, and I still fucked it up. But anyways, one of the things that's so amazing about this show is not just the absolutely, like, mind-bending visuals. It is beautifully shot and beautifully scored. But each of the 20 episodes is like 12 to 15 minutes long. You get this fantastic little amuse-bouche of a glimpse into a certain specific element that goes into making Chaoshan cuisine what it is. But perhaps most importantly for me, it is a Chinese language documentary series. It's not in English, and I think that informs the perspective that the show brings to the food and to the people who create it. It does not have a host. There is, you know, a voiceover that walks you through things, but there is no host. So it is completely different, and it feels completely different from these shows wherein, you know, a white person goes to China or to Chile or, you know, to Morocco and gets hooked up via translator with some local who, you know, gives them a window into whatever the cuisine being discussed in that episode is. But the focus remains on sort of like a white person's experience of this. Because this is a film or a series that is a Chinese language series, and because there is no sort of, you know, white viewpoint character to guide you through baby steps, you really, there's a richness and a fullness to it that I absolutely loved. So I could have watched 100 of these 15-minute episodes. But so the first season's on Netflix. It's called Flavorful Origins. I particularly recommend the rice noodle episode, the Lecha episode. Actually, all of them. All of them are great. They're so good. Watch
I gotta
it.
Watch this.
Yeah. Oh,
my
God.
Right up my alley.
I will say, content warning. If you are a vegan, this show is probably not for you because meat eating is, you know, layered in and through this cuisine. And meat takes a center stage for almost every, even, you know, dishes that you would assume would be, you know, vegetarian through and through often have some sort of meat base. So if that would be a problem for you, please avoid this show.
Okay. That is not a problem for me in any way whatsoever. No. It is a benefit. All right. But that was nice of you to be caring enough to, okay, whatever. Moving on to my freak out. What is my freak out? I went to a show. Man, I left my house a lot this week. It was really a problem. I got to make up for that. I went to a show that had a bunch of really great performances. So it was a fundraiser for a new magazine in Los Angeles called The Land Magazine, where LA, land, the land. Mm-hmm.
Oh, I get it.
And it was started by a bunch of ex writers from the LA Weekly. So I don't know if y'all followed last year, but that indie press and mainstream press have been under attack, and so much so that organizations have been shuttered, these outlets have been shuttered, really vindictive efforts have been taken to silence what is considered sort of liberal media. So in that, we lost the LA Weekly, which was a huge part of LA journalism culture. The Village Voice.
The Village Voice.
Right.
Yeah.
This is a huge concerted effort. And so these folks started their own independent magazine, which I think is so great. So I went to their fundraiser and there were some really wonderful performances. A friend of the podcast, Open Mike Eagle, performed. No Can Do performed. And I Brandon Coleman, who I learned about this night, is an amazing local jazz performer that was just blew my mind. So good. So lots of great music, lots of great things to support. I'm using this freak out to say, hey, if you're in LA, support this magazine, pick it up, take a look, see if it's your thing. But also generally, see who's doing local work, who's doing the local journalism in your neighborhood. What stories are they covering? What stories should be covered, and how can you support them to really amplify the voices of people doing, people that won't be covered by the mainstream, that, whatever. So shout out local journalism, Land Magazine. I'll link everything in the show notes.
Speaking of local journalism, I know we didn't get pop culture news, but did y'all see that story about that that local paper? I want to say it was in Alabama, where the editor in chief was calling for a return of the Klan and lynching.
What?
Yeah.
Good Lord.
Yeah, it was amazing. These people, so emboldened. Anyway.
Oh, boy. Well, what a wonderful way to end our show, which is happening now.
Welcome to the way that people of color live their lives. Just always on the lookout for one more shitty thing.
Always, always. You can catch us back here every single Wednesday. Stay tuned for the bone. Oh, wait. Okay, I'm going to plug the bonus episode. Something totally wacky happened to me at that show that we don't have time to share because the episode is ending, but I'm going to share it in the bonus episode. So if you want to know about this totally wacky thing that happened to me, you're going to have to become a backer of our podcast, which you can do at d.rip/femfreak, and then you'll hear this wild story.
Okay.
If you're enjoying the show, please rate and review us on iTunes and tell all of your friends when you're in the doctor's office and they're replacing your arm because you were playing too much fucking speedball or whatever the hell that fucking sport is.
Son of a ball. She was playing son of a ball, Anita.
You can check out all of our work and our other podcasts, including our Star Trek Discovery Recap podcast, which is currently airing at FeministFrequency.com. And be sure to follow us on Twitter at FemFreak to stay up to date on all the news. I can be found at Anita Sarkeesian, where I am dishing a lot of relationship advice.
I'm at Carolyn Michelle.
I am at Alita's Second Body.
Now I'm going and spiraling in terms of what that looks like. You'll have to share that with me. Okay. Our producer is Phil Circus, who also composed our theme music. Technical support by Sarah Norales. Production assistance by Taylor Simmons. Art by Jamie Varon. We'll see you next week.
Bye.
Later.